for those on the panel or in the room, please be aware that this is being filmed, I believe. I don't know if it's live broadcast or for later use by CTN, but just so you're aware of that. I have a few housekeeping announcements to make. In the interest of safety, please note that the location of and access to the exits in this hearing room, the two doors through which you enter the room are the emergency exits and are marked with exit signs, and emergency, the two doors behind the legislators, which the panel members, can also be used. In the event of an emergency, please walk quickly to the nearest exit. After exiting the room, go to your right and proceed to the main stairs or front of the fire stairs. Please quickly exit the building and follow any instructions from the Capitol Police. Do not delay and do not return unless and until your advisor is safe to do so. In the event of a lockdown announcement, please remain in the hearing room and stay away from the exit doors until an all-clear announcement is heard. You will notice that there's microphones in front of you. It's pretty easy to use. There's there's a shared mic, and each person has a button on his or her respective side. With those housekeeping details out of the way, thank you very much, everybody, for coming. I appreciate that this is our first meeting, our first real meeting. We did have the brief meeting over the phone that many of you participated in, and thank you for that. I did want to take the chance to introduce the staff of the Insurance and Real Estate Committee, which is Diane Kubek, who is sitting over in the corner. And you will be hearing from her if you haven't already. And she is in charge of the logistics. The bill that created this task force did come through the Insurance Committee, and so they are charged with allowing us to use the room and the resources of the committee staff. So thank you very much, Diane. And thank you also, of course, to the chairman and the ranking members of the committee. I am accompanied by several OHA staffers. To my right is Sean King, general counsel of the agency. To his right is Valerie Wysikowski, who is our lead program manager. And to my left is attorney Adam Prizio. And also sitting with Diane at the table is Sherry Koss. And I want to thank every one of them for their work on putting this together and the work that is yet to come. So without further ado, let us go around the room to announce ourselves. And Dr. Freeze, why don't we start with you? Just identify yourself by your name using your microphone, please.
Dan Freeze. I'm an emergency physician at Hartford Hospital and former president of the Connecticut College of Emergency Physicians.
I'm Cassandra Murphy of the Connecticut Coalition of Taft-Hartley Health Funds.
I'm Greg Shangold. I'm the president-elect for the Connecticut State Medical Society, as well as an emergency physician.
Andrew Lim, I am an emergency room physician as well and the medical director at Bristol Hospital Emergency Room.
My name is Robert Krish. I'm an attorney.
We've been introduced. Go ahead, Susan.
Do you want to? Good morning. I'm Susan Halpin. As my name tag says, I'm with Robinson & Cole, but I'm also the executive director for the Connecticut Association of Health Plans. Our association represents the six major carriers in Connecticut, including Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, ConnectiCare, United, and Harvard Pilgrim.
Hi, I'm Janice Perkins, and I'm Director of Government Relations for ConnectiCare.
Hello, my name is Joan Barrett. I'm a consulting actuary helping Ted and company on this project.
Good morning. My name is Pat McCabe. I'm the Senior Vice President of Finance for the Yale New Haven Health System.
Hi, I'm Andy Wormser. I'm a primary care physician in New Haven and a past president of the Connecticut Society of Internal Medicine.
And I'm Joseph McDonough. I'm an insurance agent in Connecticut.
I'm Seth Powers. I'm the co-director of the Center for Children's Boston-Berry.
I believe that's everybody. Thanks very much, and thank you. Thank you, Adam. This is a special meeting under special meeting rules, so we do have to approve the agenda that was sent out, and I would welcome any discussion or a motion to accept the agenda.
I'll move approval. Second.
Moved by Mr. McDonough and seconded by Mr. McCabe. Is there any discussion on the approval of the agenda? All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, please say nay. The motion carries. Minutes of our August 23rd call, which complied with the statutory request to have a meeting by the 25th of August, have been sent out. I would ask for a discussion of those minutes, and if anybody would like to make a motion to approve those minutes, that would be good too.
I'll move approval.
Mr. McCabe, thank you.
Second.
Second. Second by Janice Perkins. Is there any comment or corrections on the minutes? All those in favor of adopting the minutes as presented, please signify by saying aye. Opposed, please say nay. Motion carries. Now, this is a public body created by the statutes and of our state, and as such, we always want to have public comment. We also accept, for those who are watching, written submissions of any length can be accepted, and you should direct those to sherry.koss@ct.gov. That's sherri.koss@ct.gov for any written statements. But I do believe that we do have public comment. And is there a sign-up list, Sherry, or not?
No.
Okay. So I believe the Universal Health Foundation, has, and I do see that you have also some written testimony as well, or comments. I shouldn't say testimony, because we're not a legislative hearing.
Good morning. I'm here today because the work of this task force is important. It is important to tens of thousands of families across Connecticut who struggle every day to take care of their health needs under the pressure of high deductible health plans. The numbers just don't add up for most people. In fact, for many without significant savings or expendable income, being in a high deductible health plan equals being functionally uninsured, not merely underinsured. These people just don't go to a doctor unless it's unavoidable. A 2019 benchmark employer health benefits survey reports a 162% increase in deductible costs in the past 10 years. And a 2018 nonpartisan statewide poll of voters showed that 43% of Connecticut adults delayed or did not get care due to costs. It's highly likely that many of those people struggle with high deductible health plans. An October 2nd blog by Ellen Andrews of Connecticut Health Policy Project reports that in our state, 63% of individuals and 55% of families are in high deductible health plans. Consider Jessica, who is a self-employed therapist. She's trying her best to deliver quality mental health care. Jessica pays $15,000 per year in premiums with a $6,000 deductible. With co-pays added in, she says it's hardly worth having a plan she can't easily use. And then there's a church in Manchester that employs six people, three of whom are on the church's health plan. The premiums are $50,000 per year for the three employees, and they each have a $5,000 deductible. The church feels bad about the deductible, so they've set up a fund to help defray the cost of it, like so many other businesses. My son works at a small social enterprise organization. He pays $200 a month in premiums with a $7,000 deductible. At age 29, he just does not go to the doctor. Not many young adults living on their own, paying off student loans, can afford to take care of themselves with saddled with high deductible health plans. I'm going to skip ahead because I know I have a time limit. So, according to a 2015 National Bureau of Economic Research paper, high deductible plans may decrease costs but depress care. For example, the report tracked employees at one business that had moved from a no-deductible health plan to a plan with a $3,000 to $4,000 family deductible. The average annual spending per employee fell by 13%, but it was nearly all due to employers using fewer health care services. In fact, employees just skipped getting care, even preventative care that was free, such as routine screenings. This health care squeeze has got to stop. We are watching and waiting for relief from high deductible health plans. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Lynn Ide from the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut. Thank you, Lynn. Is there anybody else in the room who would care to make a public comment? Yes, ma'am. Please step forward and identify yourself. And if you would spell your last name as well.
Good morning. My name is Colleen Brunetti. I am a resident of West Hartford. Excuse me, Brunetti, B-R-U-N-E-T-T-I. I am speaking today as a constituent and as a patient with a rare disease. We have a high deductible health plan through my husband's employer. Our family out of pocket is around $13,000, and my personal cap is over $8,000. I have a rare disease called pulmonary arterial hypertension. My medications are over $250,000 a year, and a single medication copay is over $7,000 for a month. What I'd like to do today is bring to your attention what the copay accumulator model and the high deductible plan does for a patient like me. In 2018, I had a $6,000 copay card for a single medication that I could show the specialty pharmacy in January. They would take it, they would apply it towards my high deductible out of pocket, I would get my medication, I would order one more, and I would be done for the year. In 2019, the plan declined to apply the copay cards to my high deductible, saying this better reflected patients' out-of-pocket costs. What that means to me is I have to come up with over $7,000 in cash in January for a single medication. This has financially completely devastated the way my family has handled our finances. My medication hasn't changed, my insurance hasn't changed, my doctor hasn't changed, my specialty pharmacy hasn't changed. The only thing that changed is how a couple of companies chose to do business together, and I became collateral damage. The Affordable Care Act was put into place to protect patients like me with rare pre-existing conditions and costly medications. And when copay accumulator models are applied to a high deductible plan, the discrimination simply continues. I don't have the option of switching to a cheaper medication. There really aren't any. Ones that are more convenient, that may be a few thousand dollars cheaper. I tried one, it almost killed me. Generics are flooding the market. In my disease space, they're coming in at about 80% of name brands. 80% of $250,000 is still unattainable. So I would ask if you continue your work, that you also consider the copay accumulator model in light of high deductibles. Thank you.
That's very helpful. Thank you for coming forward. Is there anybody else in the room who would like to take advantage of the public comment period? Okay, seeing none, please remember that you can file written submissions to this attention of this body, and we will make sure to circulate it to all the task force members as we receive them, even if it's not during the day of a meeting. So you can always email sherry.costs@ct.gov. So thank you very much. This is a public body. Many of you have served on many boards and commissions, I understand, but and some have experience with state commissions and boards, but others don't. This is an animal of a different color, and there are certain rules that I want you to be aware of. And I have asked the attorneys at the Office of the Healthcare Advocate, Sean King and Adam Prizio, just to give you a little bit of the lay of the land and some of the banana peels that exist in this type of state body. Sean?
Thanks, Ted. I'm by no means an expert on freedom of information law, but I do know enough, I think, to just give a brief education this morning, especially to those of you who may not have been, are not, and may not have ever been in public service or another service on a task force or commission like this. As Ted mentioned, this task force is designated a public agency pursuant to the fact that it was created by the legislature. And as a public agency, it is subject to the state's freedom of information laws. And I just want to go over just, just really three main things to bear in mind as you're conducting the work of this task force. The first thing to keep in mind is the work of this task force has to be conducted in the course of a properly noticed public meeting such as we're in today. So I presume that when this meeting adjourns and everybody goes about their business for the rest of the day until the next meeting, most of what you're going to do day in and day out is not going to involve the business of this task force. But when you are conducting the business of this task force, it has to be part of a meeting. A meeting is a gathering of a quorum of this task force. So if Dr. Fries happens to have a conversation with Mr. McDonough, has a brief conversation about some of the things going on in this task force, that's not a quorum. Those conversations are okay. The pitfall lies in primarily this scenario where Dr. Fries emails Mr. McDonough. Those emails are conversations as well. And then Mr. McDonough wants to loop in Dr. Wormser. Suddenly you have three people on that email. And now Dr. Wormser brings in five or six other people. Now you've held an illegal meeting. So that's one thing that you just want to keep in mind when you're discussing issues that come up in the task force when you're having those offline conversations. Just be mindful of that. You can turn it into an illegal meeting inadvertently and very quickly without thinking about it. So bear that in mind. The second points I want to make relate to public records. All of the records that are created by this task force, that are collected and maintained by this task force are public record. They're subject to disclosure under Freedom of Information Law. That also includes emails. So when it's the business of this task force, I know a lot of people are using their business email or a private email to exchange with members of our office for logistical purposes, agenda setting, things like that. You should preserve those emails. Those are technically public records at that point. It does not give license to all of your private emails being subject to Freedom of Information Law. People still don't have access to those. Those are not public records just when you're conducting the business of this task force. Those are public records. They're subject to disclosure. If you ever happen to directly receive a request for copies of records, those need to be handled as requests for public records pursuant to the Freedom of Information Act. And I would just ask that everybody, if you get something like that, some kind of a request, forward it on to Sherry, and our office will handle that request from there. Any questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So that is the reason why when you get emails from us, you will often won't see the other recipients. We're using the BCC feature so that somebody doesn't inadvertently do a reply all, and then we wind up with an open meeting situation. Not that we're trying to hide who we're sending it to, but it's that way to keep you from stumbling into a reply all email that is falls afoul of these rules. Any questions about that? Okay. Okay, so now I know that folks have been appointed to this commission now for, depending, 4 to 6 to even 8 weeks in some cases. We did send out a binder of materials, some of which are available right now on the insurance committee's website, and all of which will be available soon. And we probably at OHA, we haven't yet, but we will probably put a page on our website too, so that's another location that you can look for. The documents, and certainly happy to get them to anybody who is earshot of this. If you get in touch with me or with Sherry Koss, we can get you those documents if you can't find them online. But folks have had a chance to think about their duties a little bit and perhaps read some of the materials, and I would like folks to have the opportunity to express to their fellow committee members what is on their mind and how they see this task force playing out, and just give your reflections on what we're doing here today, so that, and of course, it'll help to get us to know each other a little bit as well. I'd like to kind of keep it orderly and go in order, and if Dr. Fries, if you want to start, I should have maybe alerted you, but But if you want to start, we can just go around the ring again.
Again, I'm Dan Friess. I'm one of the emergency physicians at Hartford Hospital. I was really interested in being involved in this task force based on some work that Connecticut College of Emergency Physicians and many others on this task force have done over the last couple of years in the legislature regarding high deductible plans, both payment reforms and access to care issues for patients. Where we see this, it's not every day, but maybe every 2 or 3 days I'm involved with taking care of a patient who comes in. They have a primary care doctor, they have a specialist that they need for their condition, but they skip the follow-up, they feel like they can't go back because they have unpaid bills due to their high deductible plan, and it's become a major access to care issue. Similarly, I think with negotiating, we're going to talk about money, but negotiating contracts on the insurance side between emergency physicians and all physicians has become an issue due to high deductible plans and the transference of risk from insurance companies to patients and physicians and hospitals, which I think is something that needs to be addressed if health plans and the safety of the community is going to remain intact.
I'm Cassandra Murphy with the Connecticut Coalition of Taft-Hartley Health Funds. Our organization works with 14 different union health plans, some of which are self-insured, others are fully insured. Some have high deductible plans, but even those with lower deductibles are finding problems with people being able to access care just with their lower deductibles. What I'm hoping we can address here is the problems that make the theory of high deductible health plans not work, where there's not enough information for people to actually shop around on cost and quality. They don't have the healthcare knowledge to shop around, so they just go to someone they trust. And living paycheck to paycheck, as most Americans are, high deductible health plans are often just inaccessible to them. So I'm hoping we can find creative solutions to that.
Speaking on behalf of the Connecticut State Medical Society, which represents approximately the 5,000 physicians in the state, it really boils down to access to care. Having insurance does not equate to access to care. And when you're not able to use your insurance to see a physician, having that insurance does not equate to getting quality care. As Dan mentioned, many patients forego care, and it actually results into more expensive care. They forego follow-up. And what's happened over the last 10 years is you've seen these rise in deductibles. Our testimony showed, what that rate of increase has been in premiums, but at the same time deductibles. And at the same time, you see profits going way up in the insurance industry. And so to have an argument that says, well, if we do anything about this, it's only going to increase premiums, it doesn't really address how this business relationship has created a windfall for the insurance companies. Meanwhile, patients aren't having access to the care, and they're foregoing certain care within that they desperately need. And what happens is we have a relationship with many insurance companies, and patients have a relationship with insurance companies. They created this high deductible health plan, and then we're, as physicians, held collecting all of the money, which puts increased costs onto the physician to collect the money, and many times they don't even collect the money that they had an arrangement with that insurance company. So this whole paradigm has really led to less care at a higher cost, which is obviously not a system that is good for the healthcare of Connecticut.
Hi, Andrew Lim, emergency room doctor at Bristol, and not to echo a lot of what was said already before me by Drs. Shangold and Freeze, but for me personally, it's what we see every day, and the patients expressing concerns to me about how much this is going to cost, and whether this test or this treatment is really necessary when it is, and when we're at bedside, we can, in our opinion, we can offer what's medically necessary, and I would just like to see those concerns of the patients go away. And so for me, it really boils down to access to care for our patients.
Hi, this is Bob Krish. I'm an attorney. My background in healthcare stems from my work as a negotiator of healthcare plans on behalf of labor unions, and I'm also a member of the Consumer Advisory Board within the Office of Health Strategy. My negotiating focus has been to remove barriers to care, specifically removal of deductibles and co-insurances in order to drive and access to high-quality care, and I was intimately involved in the negotiation of what is known as the Health Enhancement Program, which governs Connecticut state employees, which as a philosophy something that is somewhat polar opposite to high deductible health plans. With respect to this task force, it's my hope that we can identify the issues that have come about as a result of the proliferation of high deductible health plans and try to resolve those in a very effective manner. And I want to reference the letter that Ted Doolittle sent to us on October 7th about tax implications of any changes that we may consider. And so we're going to want to be careful to appreciate what our suggestions would be and to resolve those tax implications, or at least give the legislature confidence in our recommendations that they will not result in adverse tax implications that would prevent some of our recommendations from going into effect.
Thank you, Bob. My name is Ted Doolittle. I'm the state healthcare advocate, and we help citizens like yourself, your neighbors, your loved ones on a regular basis who are struggling to access health care and health insurance. We help with enrollment choices. We can help with any type of administrative snafu. You know, your check wasn't received by the insurance company, and now they say you're not covered, but you're quite sure you were. That type of administrative support. And also, our bread and butter case is a case where a claim has been denied for lack of medical necessity. The insurance company doesn't feel it's needed, and we have a staff of attorneys, paralegals, nurses, and others who help folks on an individual basis with those cases. So of course we see all types of insurance, and we understand how tough it can be to explain to somebody that yes, the service is covered. It's a $1,500 test, but even though it's actually covered, you still have to pay for it. It's a high deductible. I also so we deal with that on a personal level, the way some of the physicians in the room do as well, and that is something that drives our thinking. We also are very aware of the trends in the marketplace, because we have to understand when somebody comes to us what type of plan it is. Is it a self-funded plan that's regulated by the state, or is it a federally regulated plan, an ERISA plan, or self-funded regulated by the Department of Labor at the federal level? The fully insured plans are regulated by the state. We have to know that because there are different rules, and that's what we're going to address a little bit later in this meeting, and Bob Krish referenced that as well, and that is why Bob Krish's slot is for a tax attorney who's familiar with HSAs and high deductible plans, and that was the wisdom of the legislature, understanding that there are two different types of plans in the first place, and then the tax deductibility of HSA contributions are important, and the legislature certainly would not want to interfere with that. So that renders everything much more complicated. As I started to think about high deductible plans from the perspective of our clients, the consumers around the state struggling to pay their health care costs, I started to do a little research, and I found out that really the system has been in place for about 20 years now, and it really hasn't changed. There have been some things added to the list of things that can be paid for pre-deductible. In fact, just several weeks ago, not long ago, and I believe I referenced in that letter, There was an improvement, in my view, an addition of, I believe it was 7 chronic conditions and 21 treatment modalities, I think, for those conditions that now can be paid for pre-deductible. That, of course, is an option for the companies. They don't have to write plans that pay those pre-deductible, but that is the nature of it. But other than that, there's been very little thinking about these plans. I've been in touch with the National Academy for State Health Policy, which is a group that tracks state health policy, just like the title sounds like, very distinguished and efficient group. They are based up in Maine. And I was in touch with Trish Riley, the president there, to ask about what other states are doing. And they surveyed their staff and came back with nobody really is looking at this. The high deductible plans are, I believe they have their place, and I know that there are folks in this room who have a high deductible plan who are very satisfied with it. They're, in my view, the place is quite limited. You have to have enough money to comfortably pay that deductible. If you do have enough money to pay that deductible, then it is, you know, a good deal. For others, it becomes what some of the other panelists were mentioning, really a lack of insurance or underinsurance, and I don't want to use inflammatory terms, but that's certainly the way it feels to somebody like Lynette's son who's paying $200 a month, and then if he breaks his arm, he's got a $5,000 bill. Well, he pays that himself because he's on a $7,000 plan. It feels a lot like he's throwing away that $200 a month. And, of course, that's exactly the person that you need in the system to fund us old decrepit folks, you know, who are much more expensive. So I was very interested to note that apparently this creation of this task force really puts Connecticut out front on this issue. It is a complicated issue, and maybe that's why it hasn't been tackled. I'm looking forward to seeing if we can creatively come forth with some solutions here. I am really, it's great that we have all the emergency room physicians and others in the room, but I'm very gratified that we have two very distinguished representatives of the insurance industry here who can work with us. I would love nothing better than to come up with something that works from a practical standpoint from their perspective, as well as being able to drive some relief to that segment of consumers that we can reach. That's a little bit about my thinking on this, and I was very pleased when the legislature did create this this body, and I'm glad to serve.
Good morning, and thank you for those kind words. Much appreciated. We, too, really look forward, I think, to this conversation. I think it's an opportunity.
Just as a reminder, Susan represents the plans, Connecticut Association of Health.
Connecticut Association of Health Plans, yes. So that's the 6 major carriers, Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, Connecticare, United, and Harvard Pilgrim. like I began to say, I think we appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation, because I think there is an education that we can all benefit from in putting all of these issues out on the table for conversation. And I certainly am well aware of the criticisms of high deductible health plans and understand where those concerns come from. I hope, however, that we will look at this in the broadest of contexts and understand the full range of benefits and drawbacks to these plans as we look at this issue, because one of the things that we are always most concerned about when we are advocating on behalf of the insurers is the law of unintended consequences. There are a lot of unintended consequences in this area and issue. I think a couple people heretofore have referenced self-insured versus fully insured. And any regulation or legislation that is ultimately recommended from this body and adopted by the legislature would only apply to about 35% of the market, that being the fully insured market. So So I think we have to understand that as we move forward, and what are the intended and unintended consequences of that. Likewise, I think we have to remember that premiums and deductibles are a reflection of health care costs. And I listened very intently to the woman that spoke earlier about the cost of drugs. And when you're talking about that level of cost, you are seeing that reflected in the premiums and the deductibles. And as we look at the unintended consequences, again, if we start to reduce the deductible, not saying that's a policy decision that can be made, but if you start to reduce the deductible, you are going to see an increase on the premium side. I personally am in a high deductible plan. I have a choice among plans. When I do the math, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to cover my portion of the deductible, but my company also provides a significant portion of my deductible. And it has caused me as a consumer to take a much closer look at healthcare costs, and has shown, frankly, from my personal vantage point, a spotlight on how much things cost and whether they should cost that much. And I think that's an underlying conversation that has to be had in this dynamic, because otherwise we're just, we're just playing a shell game of who's going to pay for what. And I think that's why you're seeing a push towards value-based healthcare and partnerships between providers and health plans, so that we're not paying for episodic care and that the focus is on preventive care, which I know also was addressed early on, why young people don't go to the doctor, because they don't think it's covered under the deductible. Well, as Ted alluded to earlier, there are several preventive measures that are articulated and must be paid as part of first dollar coverage. So I think there's a lot to be discussed in this forum. I hope we will have the benefit of a number of presentations that allow us to view it through different lenses, and I thank you for the opportunity to be at the table.
Oh, hi. So my name is Janice Perkins, and I represent ConnectiCare. Most of you probably know we are a local health plan. We do have members in the individual, small group, large group, Medicare Advantage, and we're the largest player right now on the exchange. And like many before me have commented, pretty much everything involving healthcare is complex, and this is as well. My hope really for this committee is that we do come to a common understanding about the scope of this issue. I mean, we hear a lot every day about the affordability, and that's for sure a concern, but also some of the downstream implications. For example, the exchange where, we have to meet certain metal levels and actuarial values within plan design, and that's all determined by a committee and not us. we don't have a vote on that. So, we do want to pay attention to that impact in particular, how it might affect the people on the exchange. And I think that's about it. Thank you.
There's a real advantage to sitting on that side of the table, I've learned today, because you get to go first. So lots of really positive.
Maybe next time we'll go the other way.
That would be my luck. I'll be sitting on that side of the table when we decide to do that. I really appreciate the comments we heard from the two ladies who spoke today about the problem about this problem and the issues it creates. I think everything that we do in our health system is increasingly being done with patient-centric, really putting the patient in the center of all of those decisions that we make and how that how the decisions that we make will impact them. We have done that in health systems and in healthcare when we talk about quality and availability. I think the place that's probably tailed off is we haven't really focused on the patient's financial journey through healthcare. We have a very complicated, confusing process that only adds to stress in what is in most instances a very stressful situation to begin with. So I think as we, I'm looking forward to working with this group to really think about how this impacts the person, the patient, along this journey, and really looking forward to coming up with some creative solutions to help ease some of that burden.
Good morning again. I'm a general internist, and sort of as such, at the point of the sword, really, along with my ER colleagues in the delivery of healthcare. And there's no question that these plans have had an impact on the pattern of care that we see, whether many patients who simply don't come in for care, or when they do come in, they're much sicker than they needed to be because they put off whatever preventive care we might have offered them. We see a lot of changes in the scheduling of patients, which puts pressure on primary care, because an area of the healthcare system is already under a lot of pressure. Patients will hold their appointments early in the year until the last minute and then cancel them because perhaps they haven't met their deductible and they're waiting to see if the deductible will be met later in the year. When they do come in, they have a laundry list of problems because they've been accumulating these problems, and it's very difficult to give them all the care they need. So the visits are frustrating, and I'm afraid not always what they might be. We get whiplash on December 31st. We go from very, very busy offices to much more quiet offices. What's the logic in that in the healthcare system? It's just a bad idea that came from the home and car insurance industry and found its way into the healthcare industry. And we've known, unfortunately, since the late 70s or early 80s that cost sharing by patients reduces both the necessary and the unnecessary care that they receive. So it's no surprise that this has played out the way it has. If we had a logical healthcare system that really was trying to do the best for the patients, this never would have been allowed to happen. But I'll close by saying, in the words of Winston Churchill, that America can be counted on to do the right thing, but only after having exhausted all the other possibilities.
Thank you. I'm the outlier here. I worry that there's little that we can actually do to accomplish anything in this regard. In 2015, in the an Access Health CT, there was one plan that didn't have a deductible. It was a gold plan. In 2019, every plan has a deductible, and in fact, the gold plan's deductible of $1,300 would have been a high deductible 10 years ago. I note in the and by the way, thank you, Sherry, for all the material that you gave us. But I noted in one of the documents, the Leonard Davis Institute, that Connecticut in 2016 has the second highest average deductible in the country, and the 75% increase over 2010 to 2016 was about fourth or fifth highest increase. Well, I just looked in preparing for this meeting at the information I had from 2015 on the exchange, and the Silver Plan, which is kind of the standard plan for people. It's the one that we use to measure the cost of care for advanced premium tax credits. The deductible in 2019 is 50% more than the deductible for that same plan just four years ago. The maximum out-of-pocket, which is the other figure that I think is extremely important for my clients, that's gone up by 30%. there isn't, high deductible health plan, as we know, is an HSA compatible plan. That's a technical term. But every one of these plans has high deductibles. And the other thing that's taken place over the, particularly the past 5 years, is changing what the deductible applies to. And again, I'm not talking about the HSA plans, since that's universal. But specialist visits are now have to apply to the deductible before they can be just a copay. Emergency rooms. I just had a friend and a client this morning tell me that he had brought his son to the emergency room. And he said, what's that going to cost me, $200? And I said, plus your deductible. Because the deductible is applied first to the emergency rooms. Blood work, lab tests, the deductible applies to. And when somebody is considering doing, having the test that the doctor asks that he or she have, and they realize they're going to have to pay the entire amount, and it may only be $150 or $200, but that's something that they would have expected they'd be paying $10 for in a copay. I do think that perhaps if there is something we can accomplish, it might be to take a look at how deductibles are applied and where they're applied. But unfortunately, I'm skeptical. I'm somebody who thinks that it's kind of like when the Affordable Care Act was written, every party was at the table, and everybody said, I'm the victim and all the rest of you are criminals. Well, I think we're all criminals too in this system. Insurance companies, forgive me, hospitals, doctors, I guess pharmaceutical manufacturers aren't here, so we can blame them. But there are perhaps some things nibbling around the edges that we might be able to accomplish. Thank you.
Thanks. That's a good note of caution. Seth, you are on the phone. If you could go ahead and give your reflections if you wish to. Seth, if you're still there, you may be on mute.
Hi, can you hear me?
There we go. Yes.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity. So I'm looking at the high deductible health question really from two fronts. The first one is as a provider group, as a small business that supports generally children, but all age with disabilities, including autism and other neurodevelopmental disabilities. And one of the challenges that we see within this population, and one of the women who was speaking at the beginning alluded to a similar circumstance, is that families who need to access chronic care for the high deductible plans, they can be at a tremendous amount of money early in the calendar year, and that can create a pretty meaningful financial burden for families. And we see that for families that come here to access treatment services for their children who have autism, and where the ABA treatment, the Applied Behavior Analysis, which is the recommended course of treatment for those children, in some cases can require up to 40 hours a week of intervention, and that becomes really expensive really quickly. So from the provider side, that's one of the things that we see. And then from a small business side, because I also do the procurement for all the health insurance for our employees, which we've provided for our employees since we opened in 1994, we've seen the cost of premium for health insurance just increase dramatically, and it's increased that at a rate much more quickly than we've been able to increase employee salaries. So one of the things that we see is there's been a healthcare squeeze on employees and their families because they have to find out where to come up with another 10 to 15% premium dollars to reflect 10 to 15% increase in their premiums every year when we can't afford to, and I would imagine other small businesses can't either, afford to increase salaries at that rate. So what we've seen is it's forced families into plans that require a higher degree of cost sharing or plans that have higher deductibles or higher co-insurance. And just this year, as we're going through the procurement for this year, interestingly, we're finding that the HSA-eligible plans, which we had offered a couple of years ago as a premium cost-saving mechanism, the premiums for the HSA-eligible plans are actually almost at parity with the PPO plans. So now where individuals to assume more of that risk, employees for assuming more of that risk, don't even see the premium savings up front. So I think one of the challenges, and I think something that this task force, I would look forward to exploring in this task force, is if there's opportunities to think about the consumer element and at the point of purchase when employees or when individuals are purchasing their health insurance plan, if there are ways to add to the price transparency, not just for the premium cost, but for what the total expected cost would be throughout that policy term. I think that as people are trying to evaluate and weigh all of the variable options and trying to understand which plan is right for them and their family, that piece of transparency could be a helpful tool in helping to guide their decisions.
Oh, thank you, Seth, and thank you for everybody else who made comments. We have been joined by State Senator Matthew Lesser from Middletown and Environs. He is the brain, this entity is his brainchild, and with that in mind, I would take the chair's prerogative to temporarily go back to the public comment portion of the agenda if Senator Lesser wishes to take advantage of that.
Thank you, Ted, and thank you to all of you. My intent is to get out of the way and let you do your jobs, but I'm just grateful that such a broad cross-section of expertise was able to come together so quickly, and that you're tackling, I think, this incredibly important issue. I think the emergence of high deductible health plans has been one of the biggest changes we've seen in healthcare in quite some time since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and it presents challenges. It presents challenges to the insurance industry, also to providers and to consumers. And I think one of the things we're wrestling with is how to we as policymakers in this building respond to that, what options are available. You're going to be looking at that, and I'm along with rest of the leadership of the Insurance and Real Estate Committee, we're anxious to see what you come up with. So I just want to come and welcome you to the LOB, for those of you who don't work here every day, and just say that I'm excited to see the work product of this important issue, and as we wrestle with the policy implications of high deductible plans.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing us to use this space for the meetings, as well as the support staff. Diane Kubek has been terrific. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll turn off the microphone over here if there's someone else coming.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Lesser. So one of the elements of the statute that created this was that this body should choose two co-chairs from among its members. I was appointed temporary chair at the first phone meeting, but I wanted to open discussion to the panel about how to move forward. We could possibly appoint two co-chairs today, or if people want to get to know each other a little bit, I'd be open to deferring that to a future date, but I wanted to give people the opportunity to comment and discuss what the panel wishes to do with that that requirement. Please, go ahead, Dr. Engel.
I'm certainly happy to keep Ted Doolittle as the chair, and if need to make a motion to do so. I think obviously there's people on different sides of the spectrum here, so I think the chair should be as neutral as possible, and certainly I think your office would support that.
Thank you. I do point out that there are supposed to be two co-chairs, so I would accept the position and serve if selected, but another person as well. Again, I don't want to put anybody on the spot, and this is our first time meeting as a group. If folks do want to reflect on this and think about it more, that's fine too. But if anybody has wishes to put him or herself forward as a candidate, you can do that now, or you could work on that between meetings. I really am at the disposal of the task force as to how to proceed. I suppose we could appoint one permanent chairman today and defer the selection to another day for the second position. But it's up to you all to discuss, and if anybody wants to make a motion of any sort in this regard, please do so.
I think it would be wise for us to just wait a bit on that. I don't feel like I'm prepared to decide that today.
Any additional comments that folks want to make? Yes, sir. Go ahead, Dr. Priest.
I would second that to the extent that I think we certainly maybe delay the second person, but I would be in support of naming one person, i.e., Ted Doolittle, today, as I think he's done a great job organizing things so far.
So moved.
So,
second.
Okay, moved and seconded. Let me make sure I understand and can restate the motion. The motion is to appoint Ted Doolittle to one of the vacancies today and to defer the second vacancy to a future task force meeting. Is that, in fact, an accurate restatement?
Yes, it is.
And Dr. Wormser, do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Is there any discussion of the motion on the table? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. All those opposed, state nay, and one abstention. Well, thank you very much. I'm honored by this, and look forward to working with whoever we decide to select as the as my partner co-chair. So now I know that we've had some discussion of some of the landscape that we have to deal with and skate over between self-funded and so forth, and the tax deductibility. I wanted to give people a little a bit more of an in-person review of those materials, and certainly as we go along here, anybody who has any questions that were sparked by the reading materials or by anything else should please feel free to jump in, and we can have this be as interactive as people like. So, but with that, I will turn it over to Bob and the OHA attorneys, Adam Prizio and Sean King, to walk us through some of these facets of the work.
Thank you, Ted, and thank you, everybody. I'm going to give just a simplified view of sort of the difference between self-funded and fully insured plans. That's a term that's been used several times in the room, but I think it's sort of helpful to have a common language, and in case anybody has not encountered this this distinction, it becomes relevant to any proposed policy changes that the state might enact for reasons that that I will get into. So, as I say, this is a simplified view, but it's possible to think of to divide the work of insurers into two functions, the first of which is to maintain a reserve of capital sufficient to cover its risk over a period of time, and the second of which is to administer claims, right? To subscribe people, to take premiums, and to maintain a network of providers adequate to the population that are served. And these two functions are often thought of as being performed by the same organization. That's sort of the classic, you know, insurance model. The insurance company maintains the reserve and administers the benefit. But it doesn't have to be the case that the same entity maintains the capital. So for typically large employers, although how large is an issue that we'll talk about, may be able to put up their own funds rather than paying a full premium to an insurance company to pay out the benefits themselves and to assume the risk themselves. So if there are fewer claims, then they, you know, save some money. They don't pay it all out. If there are more claims, they've taken the risk. And then to hire an insurance carrier to do the administrative side. which is administering the benefit to the members, to the employees. We call those self-insured or self-funded plans, and they are, this is a maybe stating it over strongly, but you can state pretty strongly that self-funded plans are not very touchable by state policy, state regulation, and state law. This is due to the preemption of a federal statute called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which the Supreme Court has held in a string of cases. It was Congress's intention to create sort of an integrated and to create a level playing field across the 50 states for employers to provide benefits for their employees. So as we heard earlier, I think the figure was something like 35% of people in Connecticut who are insured by fully insured plans. That includes the marketplace, that includes some small businesses. And those are the ones that the state would be most able to affect by regulation, by law. The other 65% would not necessarily be affected. But where this becomes interesting is where there may be policies that affect people who are coming out of a fully insured plan due to a change in employment, and going into a self-insured plan, or coming out of a self-insured plan and going into a fully insured plan. At that handoff, it might be the case that we may decide that there are proposed changes to how a deductible is calculated or whatever that affect the fully insured plan in a way that could benefit the consumer at that point. So really, at this point, I think it's important to be aware that there are limitations to what the state can do, but that those limitations, nevertheless, we can work around them to benefit consumers, even consumers who today are in a self-funded plan. Tomorrow may not be due to a change in employment status. So that's the sort of the high-level overview. I'm happy to take questions about that. Okay.
Anything else from your perspective, Bob, that we should be aware of?
Not really.
Okay. Okay, so looks like probably we'll be able to give folks some time back. I did want to make sure there was enough time for each task force member to have ample, unlimited ability to comment today. But we do need to talk about our next steps. The legislation, as you probably know, requires us to produce a report for the legislature by, is it the end of February, Sean? It's a date in February. So that gives us time, but it is a tight schedule. So wanted to get folks' reflection about the logistics to moving forward, such as the number of meetings we should shoot for, the cadence or spacing of the meetings, what folks would like to, if there's particular presentations or experts that we should solicit to come and participate, we can do that. Start to think about what our workflow is leading to a successful report to the legislature in February. So I wanted to open the floor to folks' comments and concerns about that. Dr. Wormser?
As a clinician with a patient schedule, I would prefer to have standing meetings, standing times, so that we're not varying the times. This happened to be a good time for me. We have a lot of work to cover, so I would think meetings every couple of weeks or something would be sort of what I think might enable us to get the job done in that pretty limited period of time. But if we could just have it scheduled at a fixed time of the week, that's helpful.
Oh, that's helpful. Thank you, Dr. Wormser. Anybody else want to chime in before we commit you to meeting every 2 weeks on the Dr. Wormser schedule? Because you know, OHA we're this is a priority for the agency, and we'll be here for whatever's needed. I really want I didn't come here with a schedule of meetings because I want this to work for everybody, and I want it to come from this body. So any further comments or thoughts about how folks envision moving forward? Yes, ma'am, Susan.
I'm usually here in the building, but I know from working on other councils and roundtables that oftentimes people like to meet at the beginning of the day or at the end of the day, so that they're not kind of cutting up their day by coming to Hartford. So I'll just throw that out as an option for people.
I know we do have a number of clinicians on the panel, and I know their time is needs to be established, and I want to be flexible for especially the clinicians, but everybody else. Dr. Wormser? Dr. Shangold?
My as an emergency physician, it's sort of like shift work, so my schedule's already out through December 31st, so my partners are supporting me in this plan, and so I think just getting the meeting days on the schedule, if I have a conflict already now, you know, I'll just switch, you know. One of the good advantages of working 24/7 is most people are going to trade a Wednesday afternoon if I work a weekend night. So I'm committed to being here, but just getting those dates on the schedule rather than you know, always trying to figure out the next meeting at the current meeting is probably would be a better way to go.
I was just thinking that insofar as people are coming from all over the state, the challenge with early or late in the day is the traffic. And the traffic was pretty good at this time of day, I have to say, coming up from New Haven.
I know this time, and Sherry, please chime in, this time was selected with input from the panel. Why don't you turn on your mic, Sherry? Turn on your mic. Microphone. Yeah.
Okay, it doesn't work. I have a big mouth, so.
No, there it goes.
Thank you. Okay, so as you all know, I sent out the doodle polls asking people what their best times were. We had different dates and times, but and this was one of the availabilities on Ted's calendar as well. But I'm open to if there's a particular day of the week that you prefer to have these meetings, please just let me know and I will do my best to work around the schedules, which can be a little difficult getting 15 people in the same room together. So
the quorum requirements, I believe, are seven. So we have a seven quorum requirement. I definitely want to set the meetings as a takeaway from this meeting so that people can understand and plan. I'm open to going every 2 weeks if folks are. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the frequency and number. Sean has done a little quick research, and the due date of our report is February 1st, 2020. I do hasten to add that, you know, if we want to do a quality report, and so I think making sure that we have something by February 1st is important. Making sure we have a quality report early in the session, which starts, I believe, on about February 7th or so this year, is in my view, of the utmost importance. So let's talk about the frequency of the meeting. Somebody has, I believe it was Dr. Free, suggested every 2 weeks. Is that the right cadence, or too much or too little?
So maybe we could add to the maybe it makes some sense to add to the discussion at this point what some of the topics that we want to discuss. I mean, every 2 weeks is six meetings, really. So I don't see that as overly burdensome necessarily. We're already looking at the end of October. So so I'm okay with the, but I think we ought to also talk about, you know, what some of the topics that we want to have in terms of presentations, and I think that will, you know, I think it will cement, frankly, the fact that we probably need to, you know, meet every 2 weeks or so. And, you know, I can think of a few topics, you know, you know, the tax implications. I think we need to explore more with the exchange and the whole impact of, you know, the scope of the problem in terms of numbers of people and implications that that may have. So just, you know, anybody else that that has other ideas, I think we should throw them out there now, too. So.
Yes, go ahead, Susan.
Just a couple ideas in terms of presentations we may want to consider, and maybe some can be doubled up, or some we may want to reserve for a full meeting. But I think it's important to have the Department of Insurance here and the exchange here to talk about what is offered in the marketplace, what the demands have been from their perspective, from consumers, what sells. I think, likewise, maybe an additional person from some of the broker community that's out there to talk about what they see, also from the employer community, because I think we can't lose sight of the fact that there's no mandate on employers to provide insurance. So this is an affordable option for employers to provide insurance, and if the response is an uptick in premiums by whatever X percent, you know, would they see themselves still providing access to health care insurance as part of their package? I think that's an important voice to hear from. And I think there's some emerging things that are happening in HSAs around investments and what they can be used for now and in the future. And I think it would be important for this group to hear from perhaps some of the banking community that's out there. You know, I mean, just in looking at this, I've learned a few things, you know, myself. People are starting to use HSAs as a means to pay for long-term care. Because unlike your 401k, which is taxed when you make an expenditure in your retirement, funding for your HSA is tax-free on the way in and tax-free on the way out. So, and, you know, you can reimburse yourself 20 years from now for an expense today from your HSA, if I understand it correctly. Maybe I don't, but I think those are important things for this body to understand, because, you know, if we're looking at high-deductible health plan HSA combined products, I think we have to understand the full scope of those things.
Ted?
Yeah, those are great points. Please, Bob.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I think in terms of topics to be covered and the workflow leading to those topics, it was mentioned that there are certain limitations to our work based on self-insured and insured, and that part of our job is to be creative with respect to solutions to those limitations from the perspective of the consumer. We've heard some of that today, and the record is replete with some of the issues. So I would think that the earlier we can get out onto the table some of the fixes, proposals to make things better within a high-deductible health plan, the quicker we can identify those and then run them by perhaps a banker, a tax attorney, because if you read publication 969 that we have, it's not exactly easy reading. And so I think that if we're going to get something on February 1st, 2020, and it is going to recommend some changes to the way high-deductible health plans are administered in the insured environment, then I want to make sure that we've taken the steps to ensure that we won't get tripped up by some of the tax questions that may arise. So somewhere down the road, somebody from Treasury Department, someone from the IRS, someone from a banking community, I think has to say, well, we can do that, or here's why you can do that.
Great suggestions. Dr. Schengel.
I certainly echo the other members that about the complexity of this, and I don't want to sort of get lost in the forest here. The committee, there were a few suggestions that were bills last session that then sparked this meeting. And I just a question, maybe Sean can answer this, is if the reports due February 1st, our work, I assume, has to be done somewhat before then, you know, so just to refine the timeline, unless I guess if Sean's writing it, he's going to be up all night to pull in an all-nighter before the February 1st. But I assume we have some time that we're all going to vet this report as well, so it's really not even up to February 1st. So if we getting those specific topics on there and not try to tackle everything in healthcare, although that would be great, but to spoil this opportunity and not take a first step and have some specific fixes would be a shame of the intent of this. So I think getting those, I think Bob said this, to get those specific fixes out there so that they can be vetted by everyone and we can have the debate of the experts around here so that we can at least come with some specific fixes. And certainly, last session's bills, you know, are two ones, and we can have more debate on those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Anybody else want to jump in here? Or Seth on the phone, Dr. Wormser?
Well, I'm really going to stake my foot in it now. But there's an existential question. Should deductibles really be in a health insurance market? Because they're a very harsh method of cost sharing, and they're regressive. They impact poor people much more than rich people. So I would posit the question for the people we invite to this meeting, should these plans be in some way sunset and just not allowed? I don't know if any other countries have deductibles in their system. There are methods of cost sharing, but is this one that really makes sense? And I am particularly, personally, sort of horrified at the way the incentives for healthcare change with the dates on the calendar. That really bothers me. I think that we should have a system that works the way, as best it can, all through the year, regardless of the date. Deductibles don't do that. So something we should explore, in my opinion, is no deductibles.
Okay. Yes. Susan.
I just want to reiterate, and I think we're going to have to reiterate this several times throughout this conversation, which is if we did act to do something like that, we would only impact between 30% and 35% of Connecticut's market. So I think that going back to, I can't remember whether it was Bob's or whomever's original point of what can we do in this product, and would we in fact drive more people out of the fully insured market? And I think that's why it's important to hear from the exchange too, because Janice and I were just discussing, I think we need to know whether individuals who purchase on the exchange have the option of choosing a non-deductible plan, either now or in the past, what the cost differential is between those two things, and are they affirmatively choosing a deductible plan? Because I think those are some of the considerations we have to make when we look at this issue more broadly.
Yes, good points. So thanks to everybody. Anybody else want to weigh in on this aspect of the discussion? I have a lot of great suggestions. the exchange has come up a couple times, Department of Insurance, broker community, employer community, banking or HSA community, and I certainly agree, tax. Certainly agree the HSAs. I mean, I believe that the HSAs, if you keep that money growing and you don't have health care needs when you hit a certain age, and I think it's 65, but you can take that out for non-healthcare purposes as well. So it's a double tax advantage plan that is pretty attractive.
If you take it out for non-healthcare reasons, then it's taxable. It's like an IRA.
Right.
But yes,
it becomes like an IRA.
But you can use it for Medicare premiums as well at 65.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so that's tax-free.
Yeah, so all very important stuff to note. Yes, Dr. Shangle.
So just in that list that you had there, one thing we haven't really, I guess, spelled out completely is the transference of the bad debt, right? And so some of this is that physicians have been left to, when I think we mentioned that when patients can afford a high deductible, even if they don't like it, they can pay their bills, even if they, somewhere along the line. The real issue, and then we talked about the patients that can sort of afford it, and maybe they can go into some payment plans. And so now physicians are floating non-interest loans. I think some of the articles that were in this packet explain that, where there's a 2 or 3 year non-interest loan payment to providers. But the big problem for physicians is now, one, this debt collection interferes with that doctor-patient relationship. And that we haven't really spoken about that. And also, that we're left, we didn't create these products, but we're left collecting all of that bad debt. And, you know, we can certainly talk about the tax implications of that, which that it's not favorable to providers. But whatever we do, you know, the deductibles have a role, don't have a role, but just the fact that somehow all of that risk has been put onto the providers is, again, it just interferes with that. So I don't know how what program that fits into or who's going to give those reports to it. I can certainly give my opinion, but I think that has to be addressed.
Yes, well, before I hear from Susan, let me just respond that our Office of the Healthcare Advocate partners on a regular basis with the UConn Health Disparities Institute, which is led by Victor Villagra, and he's obtained some small claims data from the courts that's very interesting, and so he can speak to that aspect, and is doing some scholarship right now on the impact of that debt on the doctor-patient relationship. So we actually have a national expert that is right down the street that I'm sure we could probably tap into. These are all great suggestions. I will say that we put together these documents. I don't want OHA to drive the discussion, and obviously selections of the documents is already somewhat driving the discussion. I gave you guys a flavor of what I have on my hard drive. This is like 10% of it. I mean, I have a lot of stuff, and there's a lot of things out there to read. So I'd certainly urge everybody here, if you have materials that you want to share, if you get them to us, we can disseminate them to the task force and to the public that's interested. But I think somebody over here had a comment. Yes, Susan.
Just an issue to add to the bad debt conversation, because I really don't know the parameters for it, but I do know a lot of providers have been requiring patients to put credit cards on file with their offices to cover any deductibles, et cetera, that aren't reimbursed by insurance. And I think that's an important thing to at least understand what the rules and regulations are for that.
That's good. Bob, I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot here, because I know you've done work with Mark Fendrick, who is a practicing physician out in Michigan, who has set up something. I forget, maybe Bob knows the exact name of his outfit, but he's been struggling with how to improve these high deductible plans for a long time, and he, in fact, was a driving force behind the recent changes where the IRS did add those chronic conditions. But I know that Bob has worked with Dr. Fendrick, who's a very excellent speaker and presenter, and he might be somebody that we can try to get in at least by phone, if not in person as well.
Can Dr. Fendrick heads up the Center for Value-Based Insurance Design out of the University of Michigan. His co-director is Michael Chernow of Harvard Medical School, and he has he's sort of the inventor of value-based insurance design, which is predicated around lessening or eliminating deductibles for high-value services so that people can access them. In the recent efforts by Dr. Fendrick and the center, what they have done is introduced legislation in Congress to enlarge the safe harbor rules that are in your materials so that those are the services that don't pertain to the deductible. You can just access those services, and it was really that legislation that has expanded the coverage of matter of services that are exempt from the deductible, and that's very important because I think it highlights sort of one of the inherent contradictions, in my view, and in other people's view, of a high deductible health plan. It impairs the ability to get basic screening services ahead of time, so that it leads to, as the literature points out, a delay in seeking care. So when they do show up at the emergency room, you've got a bigger bucket of problems. So, yes, I think Dr. Fendrick can shed some light on why he's been so involved in trying to increase those safe harbor services.
Anything else on this really rich list of topics that we will work with you guys to knit into the meetings going forward? Anything else on topics that we should cover at future meetings? So going back to the actual logistics, and I do want to walk out of here with people knowing what the schedule is. Janice pointed out that every 2 weeks really results in only about 6 meetings. Should we consider, if this is a time and place that works, should we consider making this a standing meeting on this day of the week every 2 weeks, at least until we get up closer to the date, end of the year or something like that? Yes, sir. Dr. Shangle.
Sorry. After October 30th, so just I'll be away at our national conference, which the American College of Emergency Physicians is the 24th to the 30th, so I'll be flying back from Denver that day. So I know I have a conflict with that day, but going forward, I think we can do it, but maybe the next meeting, I might not be able to attend if it is that 30th.
Yes, Mr. McCabe.
Yeah, I appreciate what the doctor said, but I think if we don't set up a biweekly meeting, if we wait till a certain date, we'll never get them in. There's not going to be perfect attendance at these meetings, given that we all have other roles and responsibilities. But I think we have a better chance of perfect attendance if we get it on the calendar now for an extended period of time.
Any further additional thoughts? I do agree with Mr. McCabe on that myself. Can you turn on your mic, please?
Yeah. Obviously, I don't know. I didn't go through the calendar yet, but I don't know if Christmas and Thanksgiving, you know, the Wednesday right before Thanksgiving. If
so,
it's that
you know, the traffic on Christmas would be great. Absolutely no problem.
I'm working.
Okay, well, setting aside the Christmas week, should we go ahead and at least pencil in those dates? Okay, and maybe we can decide what to do on that Christmas meeting at a future meeting. Yes, Dr. Fries.
My only other thought is because and I'm fine doing it every 2 weeks, which is fine, but the question is, with it, that current schedule every 2 weeks conflicting with both Thanksgiving and Christmas, do we want to alternate to that other week, be it the next one's in 3 weeks, the next one's in 1 week, and go those off weeks that wouldn't conflict with the two holidays?
I was going to make the same suggestion. I think it's a good idea.
If I was smart, I was going to make the same suggestion, but I wasn't.
If you had a calendar.
That's a terrific suggestion. Did you have another comment? Okay. Well, then I would seek a motion to proceed on that basis, biweekly meetings, but shifting the week so that the first meeting, let me make sure I understand, the next meeting after this one would be in 3 weeks, not next week?
I don't have a preference, but I think 1 week is going to be a quick turnaround for most of us.
Gotcha. Okay. So we would start 3 weeks from today, and we continue on through to the end of the year. And that will give us plenty of time. We can set those later meetings that may occur in January. We can set them maybe, you know, not we don't have to, I don't think we have to set them at today's meeting. Is there a motion to proceed in that manner? Mr. McDonough, thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Dr. Wormser was a second. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed, please state nay. Any abstentions? Okay, motion carries. Good. So now I believe that we're close to the end of the agenda. I wanted to just make a quick announcement about it's denominated on OHA logistics, and it does have to do with logistics. But it's a personal announcement. I am a testicular cancer survivor, and that's good. I have just received information that I've had a recurrence, and that's bad news. The good news is that I've never been subjected to chemotherapy, and it's very sensitive to chemo, but I will have to undergo chemotherapy, I think. I'm having an appointment with an oncologist tomorrow. But the further good news, so that's the good news, because I do think this thing is very curable and treatable. The further good news is that I'm flanked by two folks, Sean and Adam, either one of which could step in as needed. I do have the authority under the statute to designate somebody, and I hope this won't interfere with the work, but to the extent it does, I will not hesitate to designate one of them to move on in my place. And I actually am blessed that I have actually full confidence that either one of them could do it and understands the issues and shares the agency's perspective on this and would do a great job. So because this cycles are probably going to coincide very closely with actually the lifetime of this task force, I felt in all fairness I should alert you to the situation. I'll be, of course, doing as much as I can. So that's that item on the agenda. If there's anybody that any other business that anybody else would care to raise? Seeing none, I would seek a motion to adjourn. Mr. McDonough moved and Bob Chris seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor? Aye. We're adjourned. Thank you very much.